Hi everyone, this is David Wood. Welcome back to Wood on Words. This is a special episode because in part, as I said last week, I'm going to be on vacation in a couple of weeks and you're going to be hearing this while I'm out of town. So I'm not going to sit down and actually record podcasts while I'm traveling. But the other reason is that we are in the middle of our Adventure Writers Retreat and I am here with Nick Thacker and Sean Ellis. Nick and Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. You can't hear me waving, but I am.
Yep. And Sean's wife is here with us. She's sort of his business manager, but we're just going to let her sit here and make sure we behave while we're running our mouths. Guys, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do? We'll start with Nick.
Well, thanks for having me on. Man, I'm excited. I am finishing up my first full week as a full-time writer. But this is
Words have you actually made?
Yeah, I was gonna say this is the first day that I've even gotten any writing done in that week because I was doing car stuff. But this is a great way to launch my my new career, my new life. So I'm down here in New Mexico, originally from Colorado Springs, and just been writing action adventure thrillers since 2012-ish, and loving every minute of it. So I'm really, really excited to see what this turns into.
And Sean here. If you listen to this podcast, you probably heard my name. So what have I been doing lately? I've been working on the next Jade Ihara book, which will be called Exile, about a third of the way through that. And generally just getting ready for kind of a whole new marketing relaunch. That's the big plan, to work on creating a brand, adventure brand.
Well, let's talk about this, and Ceci, Sean's wife, you can even jump in. One of the things you've done is create a new website. Kind of talk about what your thoughts were with the design for that, what you wanted to accomplish.
Whoa, you should have submitted these questions in writing ahead of time. We were looking at trying to create brand, so lots of adventure versus thriller, which I mean, we kind of all of us kind of identify as thriller writers, but thriller can embrace a lot. It can be, you know, yeah, political thriller, the crime, things like that. And I really have always been drawn to that adventure, the Clive Cussler, the James Rollins, where there's lots of man against nature going on, even while there's this existential threat. So what I was looking at was trying to kind of create this almost, it's a little more upbeat than the thriller vibe, but it's all about, you know, man against nature. And that kind of ties in with some of the other stuff I'm working on where, like the young adult novel I've got out just recently, Camp Zero, the push there is to bring in lots of real world survival tips and things like that. Stuff that I'm interested in doing in the real world anyway, to kind of make that the brand that I'm trying to work on. So we're trying to bring that to the website. We've got a page that's just for adventures, and those are adventures that I haven't had yet, but you know, if you build it, they will come. Oh, yeah. My business manager just reminded me. The website is SeanEllisAuthor.com. That's the new website.
Okay, we'll put up a link to that. And she's being polite. She's just letting the guys talk this time. So she's going to hang and make sure we don't screw up. Nick, talk about your brand. What do you perceive your author brand is, and how do you express that?
So I use one phrase that was originally thrown at me as an insult to describe my author writing or my writing career, and that's airport books, airplane books. Mm-hmm. Somebody said that in a scathing review. It was actually a blog post review. They took the time to really spell it out how bad it was. And they described it as, you know, the crap you would pick up at the airport before you went on a business trip. It's trash novels. It's throwaway stuff. Well, I actually started writing the books that I liked to read because I thought that was a smarter idea than trying to write stuff I didn't like to read. And the stuff that I like to read is exactly that. It's stuff that I want to pick up, to be entertained, to just shut the brain off for a couple hours maybe, or, at best, you know, turn the brain on and start thinking about all these different ideas that come together scientifically or politically or whatever, and then weave together into this cool story. So that's the kind of stuff that I wanted to write, and I think airplane books is the perfect way to describe it. I don't think any of them are set in an airplane, so there's nothing to do with, the plots, but.
You should do a one with snakes.
I should. That's
nobody has ever done that.
Sam Jackson to narrate the audiobook, perhaps.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, you talk about reading what you know, writing what you like to read, and one of the things that we mentioned early on in this podcast is this is aimed at commercial success, and realistically, those are the sorts of books that are going to give you your best shot of having commercial success. There's nothing wrong with writing literary or in a tiny niche that's your favorite. But on this show, we're mostly about selling books. And I certainly describe my books as pulpy airport-style thrillers at times. I didn't give you guys a chance to talk about your actual works. Now, Sean, you've written with me. You've written with Jeremy Robinson. You've written in Jerry Ahern's universe. But you actually have written books all by yourself.
I don't remember, actually. Yes. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, talk a little about some of your series.
So, series-wise, I got started writing a sort of Indiana Jones-type, modern-day Indiana Jones-type character named Nick Kismet, which I know sounds like it should be the name of a professional wrestler. Hmm. It sounded like a good idea at the time, and I kind of ran with it. And that is very definitely in that Indiana Jones sort of vibe, where there's a familiar treasure MacGuffin. Like, for example, the second book had to do with looking for the Golden Fleece, Jason and the Argonauts. And I can remember, and this has been years since I wrote these books, I tended to think that I really needed to have these elaborate action sequences that would go on for several chapters. And I don't know if that was a good idea or not. It was a lot of fun to write. But, you know, you learn. Every book is, hopefully every book is better than the last one. Also, about the same time, I was writing the Dodge Dalton Adventures of Dodge Dalton, which is, that's more in the Indiana Jones vibe, a lot like your Brock Stone adventures. It's a period piece set in the 1930s, very Doc Savage, Indiana Jones kind of vibe going on there, and a little more sci-fi maybe, but... there's four books in that series now, and I really, I love that series. I love telling stories in that universe, and I know you've had the same problem, though, with talking about commercial success. Sometimes you have to, know which way the wind is blowing, and if something just isn't grabbing the audience the way it grabs you, you got to know when to
One of the reasons I keep putting off writing the second Brock Stone. It's a really fun story to write, and I will get to it. But like I said, the audience is smaller, and I think that a lot of those readers, they like to search used bookstores for the old paperbacks and read the things that they've always loved. They're not really looking for new voices in that old genre sometimes. So that's not 100% true, but it certainly is a bigger challenge. Nick, tell us about your work.
Well, the first book I ever wrote, not even kidding, I mean, I hated writing all my life, and so... didn't do any kind of dabbling in, short stories or anything. I just went for it. Just decided I was going to write a novel one day. It was never meant to be read by anyone other than my dad. And honestly, I didn't even expect him to get into it very much. I was going to give it to him as a gift on Christmas. And so I did. I finished the book. It was, it's a longer story, of course. But I finally finished it. And, he said, hey, you ought to, get this published or, whatever. I didn't know anything about self-publishing. And so I realized that finishing that book and producing it and getting the cover done and all that, I really enjoyed the writing process, but what I really, really loved was just the overall process of creating a book, from nothing. And so while I was writing the second book, The Depths, I kind of fell in love with this idea of self-publishing because I had control over all the different facets of it. So it's sort of an interesting origin story for me as a writer because a lot of writers come at it a different way. But I had a marketing background, and I was very in tune with the commercial side of it, I think, because of that. And so when the third book, The Enigma Strain, was written, I started to see some more sales of that when I was getting better as a writer, and I think readers were latching on to that one more, so I made that a series, and well, the rest is history. So I've got The Enigma Strain was the first book in the Harvey Bennett series, and that I'm working on the fourth one now. I've written a short series with Kevin Tomlinson called The Lucid, and I've done a sci-fi post-apocalyptic thing called Relics. And then I've got a couple standalones as well. So that's sort of my omnibus there.
Okay. Do you find that your series sell better than your songs?
Really. I think I was just looking the other day. The second book in that series, The Amazon Code, is actually my bestseller, I think, of all time. So, and it's close. But yeah, I think it's The Amazon Code and then The Enigma Strain. But collectively, that series far outsells my standalone books.
Now, Sean, you've got a terrific book called Magic Mirror, but a lot of people have not discovered it because it's not attached to a series, so just mathematically there's a little less of a chance of coming across it. Talk about that story.
Magic Mirror was actually, I don't know if I would say it was the first book I wrote, but it sort of was the first book I ever wrote for publication to completion. So when I finished the manuscript for it in 2002, I intended it to be part of a series. Magic Mirror is it's sort of a... It was more of a mystery than a thriller, but it's definitely got an adventure aspect. The hero of the story, his name is Michael Rook, not to be confused with Michael Rooker, the star of Guardians of the Galaxy and The Walking Dead. The character was an adventure racer and somebody who got involved in I want to call them eco-crusaders. Monkey wrenchers. And again, this was right about 2001, just post 9/11. He's part of this group of monkey wrenchers and he realizes they're planning something really bad, so he kind of dimes them out and goes to the FBI. And so now he's kind of just living in the Northwest, minding his own business. He's doing adventure races for a living. And adventure racing is something I always loved. That is triathlon on steroids. It's not so popular anymore, but back then it was really kind of a big deal. The guy who created Survivor, Mark Burnett, he was involved in these adventure racers. And what they are is a team of people who go out and they do 400-mile course of mountain biking and kayaking and sometimes horseback riding.
A friend of mine actually published and edited a magazine that was big for a while that was all around adventure racing. He was an adventure racer.
Yeah, I love that stuff. And so that I decided this would be my hero's skill set. He's kind of had his one foot in this world of eco-terror, even though he's not an eco-terrorist. He's got this, you know, all these specialized skills for adventure racing, and then he finds himself in the middle of a mystery involving somebody, a scientist who went missing like 15 years before. And the inspiration for the story, I talk about the inspiration for the story because that's really sort of where I got the idea for it. I was watching VH1 Behind the Music. They were talking about Iron Butterfly, and the bass player for Iron Butterfly, the rum's kicking in, Philip Taylor Kramer, was after his career in music, he went on to become a physicist working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. And then one day, he calls his wife on the phone from, I guess, from a payphone, probably, given the time frame, and says, "I'll see you on the other side." And then he was never seen again. He just disappeared. And I saw this story on Behind the Music, and I thought, wow, that'd be a great idea for a story, like some kind of X-Files type story with what really happened to this guy. Did he discover a way to teleport or go into another dimension or something? And as it turned out, they actually found his body. He had committed suicide and driven off the road somewhere, and his body had gone undiscovered for like 15 years. But the idea was there, so I went ahead and I wrote the story about somebody like that who disappears under mysterious circumstances. And it's very much a supernatural explanation for it. And then my hero discovers his body at the bottom of a lake in Oregon, and that starts this story going. And, you know, it's my first novel. So readers who read it will be like, wow, that's no good. Bear with me. So. You know, every book is better than the last one. And that was my first. But I still feel passionate about it. And I intended for that to be the first book of a series. And it just, you know, it never didn't catch fire. So I moved on. And I think that I'd still love to go back and revisit that character. But after this many years, it's like kind of, you know, I don't know if I want to just take the lid off that box.
Now, did you ever intend to be an independently published author?
No, I still don't. My intention is to become mainstream, traditionally published success story superstar. So I'm still gunning for that. But the thing I discovered, and one of the things with this, is I wrote this story and I gave it to my agent at the time. So it must not have been the first book I wrote, because I already had an agent. When I gave it to him, though, and he just wasn't enthusiastic about it at all. And I realized this book is never going to get published. And again, this was 2000, it must have been about 2005, I think, now putting this into perspective. But my sense at the time was, if I don't self-publish this, or find some independent publishing avenue for it, it will never get read. And I want this book to be read. And so I still feel that way. I mean, I don't write a book to put it in the drawer. I write it to be read by people. And I haven't really pushed Magic Mirror marketing-wise like I should, maybe. But I think that if you've written a story, my philosophy of writing is this. If you've written that novel, that first novel, and you've made it as perfect as you can, do your best to get it published the traditional way. You know, write your query letter, do your research into markets, you know, publishers, find an agent, try that. If it doesn't work, then you can always go the independent publishing route. You can do self-publishing. A lot of people, I think, get into self-publishing because they see dollar signs. They hear stories of people who've, you know, made millions of dollars self-publishing, and that's great, but you know, it should be about trying to connect with readers. And
yeah, I do advise people, as much as I believe in the potential of self-publishing, that if you have even the tiniest feeling that you want to be traditionally published, do that first. Absolutely. Because indie will always be there for
you. If nothing else, it's a learning process. You learn what that's like. And you're going to get feedback in the process, too. You're going to get agents telling you, look, your story is good, but there's 10 other books like that out there, and I can't sell this. Or you're going to get, you know, this is horrible. You need to, you know, keep your day job.
Yeah.
You're going to get, it's going to be instructive, and if nothing else.
Well, I do want to circle back around to that. There's 10 other books like that. But Nick, tell us how you came to be an indie published author.
So some of the same sort of things that Sean's talking about, I'm really resonating with. I mean, I wrote The Golden Crystal in spring and summer of 2011, and I went to Lulu, I think, because I wanted a hardcover. Or maybe I might have even used Blurb back then, but I wanted a gift for my dad. That was it. It was never meant to be sold. And then I discovered that I could make ebooks, and Amazon had this tiny little thing called Kindle that they were doing.
Which tells you how young he is, folks, because they didn't even have that when Sean and I started.
Right. I came in at the right time. You know, I was just after the big, you know, $1 million a month blow ups that Conrath and guys like that had. They changed their algorithm a little bit and stuff, and so that was when I was starting to play around with the ebook stuff. But I tried querying, I tried getting, you know, an agent. I didn't try very hard. You know, I might have sent it out to 3 or 4 different publishers. So it certainly wasn't the Stephen King, you know, try 99 times and nail them to the wall kind of thing. But I definitely think there's a lot of value in that learning experience for me. Yet for me, the decision wasn't just, the feedback loop that involves. I think there's another one in self-publishing as well, but it's directly from readers and potential buyers. And so that sometimes is even harder to swallow because an agent letting you down easy is different than a reader saying, well, this book sucked and I'm going to give you a 1-star review. I didn't do it because of that. Actually, I liked the control that I had in the process. And everything I read about traditional publishing said that most of the time the publisher is going to make a lot of those calls, like the cover, the editor, who they're going to work with for different things, and that sort of stuff. And so I'm not saying that I'm opposed to that at all. I think there's absolutely some value in working with a team in that way. But the question I always ask a potential, you know, indie author or traditionally published author is, how much control do you want? Do you want to actually feel like you're running a business? Because you are going to be running a business if you indie publish. I love that. I'm very entrepreneurial minded. I did some classes at business school and just fell in love with that. I wanted to run the business. And so this indie publishing thing is a perfect marriage between the business side of things and the writing creative art side of things. But if people don't want that other side, they just want to do, you know, they just want to write the books and create their worlds, traditional publishing is absolutely more for them. So that was my long answer, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talked about your first book, and it's interesting. You know, Sean's first book was indie published because he wanted people to read it, and it just wasn't, for whatever reason, right for the agent. Yours, you wrote it as a gift. My situation was I was going to be a fantasy author, and I'd been working for a long time on this fantasy book, and I heard about National Novel Writing Month and thought it sounded fun. And I had a vague idea for an adventure story, which basically consisted of a shipwreck, and I wanted Petra, and I wanted the character to be kind of like Dirk Pitt. And so I wrote it. It was far too short to offer to an agent. I wasn't sure I wanted to write action adventure, But, like you said, I wanted somebody to read it. I figured if I published it somewhere, my dad would buy a copy, my mom would buy a copy, things like that. So I heard about Lulu, put it up, and the damn thing started selling, and then I had to grapple with the fact that it was virtually unedited. It had huge weak points. I had made the cover with Microsoft Paint. But in the process of correcting many of my errors, I started to really enjoy independent publishing. Mm-hmm. And in my case, you know, I was very fortunate when Kindle took off. I did too. And so to commit the amount of time it would take to seek traditional publishing, I'm still struggling with. Although I would sort of like to have that kind of validation. There are days when I think, most days I don't feel like I need it at all, but there are days that I think, you know, I really would like to be able to say I'm published by the Big Five. That would be cool.
That's interesting, because I never, again, I came into it so late. You know, I never wrote when I was a kid and you know, becoming an adult. I read books, but I never wanted to write them. So I never had that struggle, but I hear that so often, but I never had to deal with the validation side of things. You know, it was always like, well, no, I just want my book out there. I don't care how it got on Amazon. I just want people to be able to buy it. So
for the record, if I had to choose between money and validation, I'll take the money, but the validation would be
validation
nice.
Sure.
Well, as people who are working in the indie space, regardless of aspirations we might have, what challenges are you bumping up against? Sean, what do you find challenging about being an indie author and an author who writes for small press and indie press?
So it's the difference between the dream of what I want to be and what I am. So I want to tell stories for a living, and that's good. In order to make a living telling stories, the output has to be, I have to work all the time. And, you know, the dream of being an author is the dream of writing a book or two a year and then spending the rest of the time traveling the world doing research. And right now, in order to pay the bills, it's more like writing, you know, 6 or 7 books a year. Now, to be fair, that's not unusual. I mean, if you know anything about the history of before self-publishing was, and back when it was not a thing, when the only self-publishing opportunity was Vanity Press, which was not, that was a confidence game. Mm-hmm. But authors that, you know, people talk about today as the, you know, the classics, they were writing 5 or 6 books a year, and they called them potboilers. They were doing them under pseudonyms. And a lot of the authors that people, you know, love today were actually writing, just the output was incredible. 10 books a year under pseudonyms that, you know, people would never know that. And it's emerging now a little bit more and more, but like people like Michael Crichton or Lawrence Block or Louis L'Amour, I mean, they wrote books all the time. That's all they were doing all the time was writing. And so it's not that unusual for me to be writing 7 books a year, except it's just not the dream. You know, the dream is to be, but you know, even Stephen King is writing 10 books a year too, so
he just likes to do it.
But you know, so that's part of I guess the challenge. Challenge, I think, is it's not a problem. It's more of a challenge in the good sense. It's you know, I've been challenged to increase my performance. I feel like if I can even just double my sales, I'll feel much safer financially, and be in a much better place. And it's really, that's not unreasonable. I mean, if you think about it, no matter where you're at as an author, the number of books you sell, double it. You know, if you're only selling 10 books a month of your first book, set your sights on doubling it. And, you know, that's not going to seem like much more money in your pocket at first. But, you know, if you double your sales on that first book, and you're writing the second book, and now you've got the second book out there, and you just keep thinking, double it all the time, double it. It's gonna matter in the end. You know, I've given up counting my books now, between novellas and so forth. It's over 30, and I can't keep track. So they're all out there still, and if I can just keep them alive, keep people interested. Talking about Magic Mirror for the first time in however long, you know, I want to get that book out there.
And you made one sale. Nick got on, grabbed his phone,
right,
and bought one.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
You must have been persuasive.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
And so, you know, that's just it. Just, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about marketing. And, well, you're always going to be marketing. You can't leave that aside. But have a specific goal. And if that specific goal is just doubling your sales, that's not unreasonable.
You talked about having to write all the time to make ends meet and not being the dream. One of the things we're learning with the internet and with authors being more transparent is how many mid-list authors are either being supported by their spouse, supported by a day job, or, like you said, doing a lot of other things. We're seeing authors that we consider very successful resorting to Patreon to say, hey, support me so I can quit my day job. And it's like, wait, that person still has a day job? What we see in the movies is somebody finally finishes their first manuscript, right, and boom, they're in Tahiti. And it just isn't reality. And a lot of this traditional publishing schedule of one book a year, it's artificial because of what they think are the realities of marketing and just their own load.
Recently, I went to a book signing. I'm not going to name the authors. One of them is a New York Times bestseller. He publishes two books a year. And the other two, I don't even know their names, so I couldn't tell you. But all three of them keep their day job. And that may be for love of the day job. Mm-hmm. I don't know. This is my day job. It's our day job, all three of us. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, if I'm writing for a living and writing round the clock, why should I complain? That's what I wanted, right?
There are a lot of people listening who are jealous right now. Even though we're working hard.
That's true. I think it was Russell Blake's blog, and he wrote on there, being a full-time author isn't winning the lottery, it's buying a restaurant. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like your restaurant's only going to be successful if you show up and work in it.
Unless you're Hugh Howey floating around on your boat naked.
Well, there's certainly those guys in the world, but
We love you, Hugh.
You know, I think they're the exception that proves the rule, but we say we want to write all the time, and now we get to do it. It's like, well, what does that look like? That's my challenge. I mean, that's what our challenge was, is, I've got two. I've got kind of a low-level and a high-level one, and the low-level one is just that. It's the challenge of facing all these different marketing tactics and strategies we can try, and, you know, this chasing the silver shiny object syndrome thing, and just having to wake myself up and say, you know what? What's really important is just to sit down and write the next book and just get that next one. I mean, that's the formula. If everyone listening is looking for the silver bullet, that's it. You just write the next book. And you're probably not going to have one that takes off like Hugh Howey's or someone else. You're probably actually just going to have 50 books and making a killing, but it's because all those 50 books are adding up to an awesome income. So get that next book written. That's my challenge.
Do you guys face challenges just writing on a day-to-day basis, or do you find it fairly easy just to sit down and crank your words out?
Yes and no. So there are days when I just don't. I things get in the way. But that's me allowing myself to be distracted. And sometimes that's just because I haven't figured out how I'm going to write that next chapter. And then it comes to me. I'm not meeting my daily goals like I want to. But, you know, that they're there. And I get something done every day, except for this weekend.
Hmm. Well, we got stuff done, just no new words.
Yeah. I do. That's a big challenge for me. I've got two little kids at home, 2 years old and 1 year old, and they don't like me writing and not paying attention to them. And so that's a challenge, you know. And we've got a nanny, so there's, you know, as I get into this whole full-time thing, I'll be able to go somewhere and write and, I'll build up some habits there. But for me, I think that's the problem of having a goal is if I miss it, then I failed. Mm-hmm. If I have a 500-word-a-day goal and I only get 499 words, I failed to hit the goal. But the reality is I still wrote 499 words. So I'm trying to shift my thinking to having a writing system. You know, I'm just going to sit down every day in front of a computer at this space at this time with this music playing or whatever the thing needs to be. And the words will come, and it doesn't really matter how much are going to end up on the screen or not. That's kind of how my day-to-day writing is.
Now, I'm going to say this, from your podcast, because I listen to it, mm-hmm. Mostly to hear my own name.
Yes.
But,
to find out when your royalty checks
right,
are coming.
Right, exactly. The idea that just sit down for half an hour and write as much as you can. Now, I can't do that for the main work that I'm working on. So, for example, when I'm working on Exile, the next Jay Dehara book, read the Jay Dehara books, mm-hmm. That's my 2,000 a day. My goal is usually 2,000 words a day. That's what I aim for. And sometimes I make it, sometimes I don't. But there's another story I've been working on for the last year. I call it my passion project. I don't even know if it's ever going to be published. But I decided I was going to just set half an hour a day. I will work on this as much as I can, and then I'm done. And I got for a Father's Day present, I got this wonderful hourglass, 15-minute hourglass.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So now I put that, and I turn that, and I start writing as much as I can. And before I know it, the sand's run out, and I've already produced 600 words. Right. Just in half an hour.
It's amazing how much you can write in a short period of time, as I keep talking about.
Yeah. And I complain about, it's like, I didn't make my 2,000 words today after sitting in front of the computer for 6 hours or whatever. Mm-hmm. And yet in half an hour, I get four to 600 words. So, you know, do that. Mm-hmm. You know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But, you know, how much time have you invested in it?
Yeah. And as you know, since you listen to the podcast, I'm finding that the more I shift away from pantsing to plotting, and the more I know, I sit down, I know what I have to write that day. There's very little thinking involved. I might need to do extra research or work out minor things. But that's really been the key to me being more productive. But it takes a lot more preparation, and I do a lot of my pantsing in the outline stage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What are your tips for
putting exactly the same way? I'm stuck in a book right now about 25,000 words in. Because, you know, I mentioned I do this discovery thing, a couple chapters usually of, I'm just going to have a prologue, and this guy's going to run around on a horse and discover some things, and I've got some general ideas of where the book's going to go, but I don't know anything else besides that. But then when I get to the end of that discovery process, then I can go back and make an outline, and I try to get really specific and really granular with that outline. Well, I didn't do that for this one because I'm a genius and I decided I didn't need it, and here I am stuck, you know. And so I need to just stop, go back, write the outline that I'm comfortable with, take the time to research and figure out the big, you know, holes and the characters and all that, and then jump back in. But if I don't have that outline, I always get stuck.
Now, Sean, am I correct that you pretty much kind of know in your head what you're going to do, but you don't outline, or am I mistaken about that?
No, I've become definitely an outliner.
Okay.
The books that I pantsed, I didn't really pants. Maybe I started writing them and I thought I'll just pants it, and then it's like, that doesn't work for me. I'm a real believer in outlining. You know, I honestly think that, like, with this passion project, I've got an outline for it, but at the same time, knowing that I only have to work on it for half an hour means I may only write a few sentences of the scene. And that's not that, it's not that intimidating, I just write a few sentences. And I'm still thinking in the background as I'm working on other stuff about how I'm going to finish it. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I'm going for that big 2,000 words a day, I may write everything that I've been thinking about in my head. And the outline is there, but my outlines are just kind of general.
Right.
Like I may write, this will happen. But how that happens is why I need to write 2,000 words a day. And maybe I haven't exactly figured out how it's going to happen. And that's what sticks me at, you know, I get to 800 words and I'm like stuck. I'm like, I didn't think this through. Hmm. And I, you know, sometimes I have to drive to the store and get some cauliflower or talk it out with Ceci. And it's like, I'm stuck in here. I can't. And by the time I've articulated what's wrong, I figured it out. But sometimes I just need to do that. And that's all part of that day of writing is I've spent the day talking about it, thinking about it, and finally figured it out, and then I can say, okay, now I can say, oh wow, it's already 6 o'clock. But with, you know, just short little half hour, it's not as intimidating. But yes, outlining, pantsing is bad.
Okay, so those are some of the writing challenges. Now let's talk about the challenges an indie faces getting your books in front of readers, engaging with readers. And Nick, you said you've got a marketing background. Talk about that, how that played into the decisions you made when you decided to really take indie publishing seriously.
Yeah, I worked at a marketing company out of college. I've always been, I don't know, fascinated weirdly by advertising, marketing stuff, took classes in college for it, and I've done website, all that kind of stuff. So that was all before I even wanted to be a writer. So then when I came to this book that I had created, I never had, the question was never in my mind, okay, now what am I going to do to try to sell it to people? And I think the answer, the reason for that was that I always tend to think of marketing as knowing that you aren't actually that unique of a snowflake, and there's a lot of people out there just like you, and it's just a matter of finding them and not smacking them in the face with your book, but just saying, hey, I think you'll really enjoy it. You like reading this stuff, so you should check mine out as well. And so that involves building a relationship and the connection with people. And so I never thought, okay, I finished the book, now let me shift gears and put the marketing hat on. It was all kind of this big process. And like I said, I accidentally fell into it anyway. So with this first one, I already had this book that even if it wasn't well written, and it wasn't, and it wasn't edited, you couldn't tell. It looked like it was great. It had the cover to the title down to the copyright page fit everything that I liked to read. I mean, it fit that genre perfectly because I made sure that it did. So I know that's kind of a weird answer because the question was really like what are the challenges and stuff that you face with the marketing of it, but
well, it all ties in together.
I think that my answer is well, it needs to not be a challenge. What it needs to be is a recognition that you're not writing something like you said to put in a drawer, Sean. You know, you're writing something that other people are going to read. Well, know who those other people are as you're writing the book or even before you write the book, and you will hopefully intuitively design a book that makes sense for that market. Now, again, that's the strategy. There's the tactics within it, and those are challenging. What is Twitter going to work this week, or is Facebook better? Or all that stuff is going to change, and that is certainly a challenge, and I don't know all the answers to that at all. But the strategy is easy. The strategy is write more books and always know who your audience is, and start with you, right? If you are writing something you don't like to read, you're going to have a hard time selling the book. But if you write something you like to read, figure out where you go to find those books, and there's other people there looking for that same stuff as well.
And that reminds me of this comment Sean made, something that writers often hear from agents and editors is, we've already got a book that does that, or so-and-so has already cornered the market on this. And the reality is, if so-and-so has successful books out there, that means there are readers out there that like to read that kind of thing.
Right.
And it could be, depending on genre, especially in certain commercial genres, that they're happy to have more of the same. And I think that's one of the great things about indie authors, one of the things, or indie publishing in general. I noticed early on some of the fantasy authors who had success were writing things that editors were no longer buying. The orcs and the elves and the dragons and things like that had really gone, you know, mostly by the wayside. But other people saw that as an evergreen market component. And I think a lot of us have found that straight up action adventure, there's a big hunger there for that, if we know who the authors are that are most like what we're doing, and then finding ways to say, hey, there's me too.
Well, I think it's simple. You just follow the money, right? I mean, if it's not a zero-sum game for indie authors. I think that's the difference. You know, for a big five publishing house, it is a zero-sum game, because if you write a book and you're published by publishing company A, and it does really, really well, you're also going to help sell all the books in that genre sold by some other from publishing house B. So it's, they get the money and your publishing house doesn't. But as indie authors, there's no competition between us. The more that I see your results show up in my also bots at the bottom, the more I know I'm sending my readers to an author who's going to send them back to my, like, it's just this never ending cycle, because we're both producing books that all that crowd likes to read. And there's no publishing houses that we have to pay, you know, to.
Also, it's just the idea of, if I finish a book that I really love, I look for more like it so I can have that experience again.
Exactly.
And sometimes you get the idea in certain publishing circles that a reader says, okay, I love this book, I'm never going to read anything else like this again until this author.
Right.
But there is some truth to that in certain, like, fantasy things. I think people get, you know, attached to certain authors and they don't try a lot of new things. But I feel like in thrillers and adventure, people are pretty eager for more of the same.
I think so. You know, that you definitely have your huge blow-ups. You've got, you know, what do you call it? The BDSM erotica type stuff that I'm not saying.
You had to get that in there, didn't you?
Had to get it in there, yeah. I'm not saying it's a trend, but the whole
billionaire
romance and, you know, like that. But then there's also the, you know, you had vampires a couple years ago. You get the Harry Potter wizardry type stuff. These are all things that, you know, you can write a great book in that genre, but there's certainly not as many sold as there were, you know, 3, 4, 5 years ago. But like
you
said,
you don't need as many
as
an indie.
Yeah, exactly. As an indie author, you just need, hey, if you are just, you're going to read wizard fiction, I'm going to write wizard fiction for the next 50 years. Oh, great. Okay, cool. Well, you're my author then. We get to do that as indies, but traditional publishing houses are going to be trying to catch that next huge wave because it just costs so much more for them to recoup their investment.
One of the things I'm hearing is that traditional is more likely to take a chance on you if you are doing new and different. But indie, that's probably not necessarily the way. If you want to do new and different, you might want to go trad publishing. Now, Sean, thinking about your own stuff, particularly the Nick Kismet books and the Mira Raiden books, and thinking about other authors out there, what readership do you think your books would appeal to? What other authors do you think are similar to what you're doing?
It would be that the James Rollins, the Andy McDermott, and Jeremy Robinson, obviously. I had one more. It's gone.
Nick Thacker or David Wood.
Definitely those guys, yeah. No, but
how about movies? Like, do you think Tomb Raider?
Absolutely Tomb Raider, and which I don't think Tomb Raider is good, is a good comparison because the movie didn't do well. Mm-hmm.
But they're fun if you like the...
Right. But it's... yeah, cinematic. I mean, that's what I'm after. Matthew Reilly. That was it.
Okay.
Matthew Reilly. There we are. I have beaten you, Rum. I think, something you said earlier about, and I wanted to get my shopping line analogy in here with, and I think this is good for all indie authors out there. When you think about strategies, if you're trying to figure out what worked for somebody else and try to copy them, you're probably going to fail just because these things only work for the first few people who discover it, and then everybody piles on and it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So it's
sort of like how Mark Dawson stole Nick's tagline
exactly.
on Facebook.
He stole
ads.
My idea. Exactly.
Yeah. He owes me a lot of money.
And so it's maybe it's not even the first person to do it. It's the second person who figures out how to do it and does it better. Mm-hmm. But the third and fourth and fifth person and the rest of us, we're all trying to do it, but that line has already gotten very long.
Which is not to say completely abandon it, but you can't realistically expect the same results if you're late.
It's kind of like, I love treasure hunting, and sometimes I go looking for treasures, even though I know they're probably not really there. But treasure hunting is fun, whether it's, trying to track down the Lost Dutchman mine or whatever. It probably doesn't exist, but it's just the fun of doing it. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to figure out how to get rich doing this, you've already failed. Hmm. If you're trying to do something you love, which is tell stories and, yes, sell books, find readers, you're just going to keep sticking at it. But if your emphasis is on trying to win the lotto, play the lotto. If your emphasis is on getting rich, you're going to make more money earning minimum wage probably than you are writing books. Even at my age, where I'm at, I could probably go get a job that pays a lot more than this. But this is what I want to do, is tell the stories. So don't focus on how do I get more sales. Yes, you have to do that. But probably the best thing you can do is to write the next book.
Now, Nick, I think your answer is probably going to be similar to Sean, but let's start with the whole other authors and
now I'll
audience.
Say the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Audiences, current authors, whose audiences do you think your stuff appeals to?
James Rollins is top of my list, all-time favorite author. But I wouldn't say my books are like his as much. He's really gotten into that Sigma Force thing and a little more militaristic. And mine are, I pull back from that a little bit because I don't have any military background. I don't want to try to write something I don't know. There's some of that, but a lot of mine is, my formula is read popular science magazine, find something prototypical and that's not quite here yet. Give it to a bad guy in an exotic location and make the good guys have to go get it. And so it's a lot of that action adventure stuff like Matt Reilly writes. Andy McDermott is up there. Jeremy Robinson, of course. I came up with it first, so okay. He just stole it from me. Just like Mark Dawson, everybody steals from me. It's a lot like yours. I look up to Dave a lot in what he's writing with the Dane Maddox series specifically. I mean, I read those and I just was like, oh, this is, I should stop writing. This is what I was trying to do. He did it better. So it's very similar to all that stuff.
And, you said your stuff isn't quite like Rollins, and I think that's an important point, is you don't have to be that other author in order for you writing the stuff that you love to appeal to that audience.
Right.
I started out trying to write a little bit of the template of the old Clive Cussler books that were shorter, faster pace, starting with the historical prologue, and then meeting your protagonist through him doing something heroic to start off the book, and having the pretty leading lady and the wisecracking sidekick. But beyond that, I'm really not trying to be Clive Cussler.
Right.
And I love for my climaxes to have a little Indiana Jones, which really pisses readers off who read 90% of it thinking they were getting a straight-up Clive Cussler. But, you know what you like, put it in there, and then identify the flavors that overlap. And yeah. Hopefully you can reach those readers. What do you guys do to try to make readers who you think would enjoy your books become aware of them?
Facebook ads are big right now. Amazon ads are getting bigger, but they've got the demographic information, but they're just not giving it to us. So those are a little trickier to tap into. But yet Amazon has something built into it, which is better than everything else, which is people come there ready to buy a book. So that's a good platform to work. Mailing lists has always been a gold mine. And I don't mean that to say that all I see my readers as are money bag, just bags of money that I can pull money from.
But it's your most direct line.
But that's absolutely what, they're definitely the ones buying my books. Every time I release one, they're the first people that know about it. And so I've just been slowly and steadily building up a mailing list for the past year or so. And that's where, most of my income comes from in residual stuff.
Now, are you sending out a newsletter blast to all your people at once, or are you segmenting it over a few days to try to spread your rankings out?
Yeah, I've done both, and I've had more success with segmenting. I'm a little lazy when it comes to it, so a lot of times I built an email service provider because I hated paying MailChimp's prices, so I don't have as much, cool little controls and things like that, but I tend to not need that as much, I've found. It's very simple, it's a very straightforward platform, but it works really well, and I can segment. And it does work for boosting rankings and everything, but I've also had a lot of success just blasting all of them at the same time.
Now, Sean, you're in a slightly different bag because you prefer to publish through small press, and you also write for other people. But as you think about your branding and are moving forward, what are you trying to do to reach readers?
So, yes, most of my success is as what I call a with author. It's blank, blank with Sean Ellis. So, and that's where most of my money comes from. I don't want that to be necessarily what I do with my life, but I can't necessarily get away from it either. So what I've been doing, and I think that this is a useful advice for the readers out there, networking with other authors. Find your author buddies who write in the same genre. So, and also identify your target market. So let's say, for example, I'll just pull a name out of the hat, Clive Cussler. You want to reach the readers who like Clive Cussler. And there are other authors out there who probably want to reach those readers too. You can network with that author, and this is something I've done for you. You may not be aware of this, but edit out the Clive Cussler. Ignore that. Author X. I'm on a fan page for him, and inevitably, you will hear people say, at some point on the Facebook, they'll say, well, I'm all caught up on reading Author X's books. What else should I read? Now, as an indie author, your first instinct is going to be, hey, read my book.
Don't do it. Don't do it. Oh, my gosh.
But if you've been networking with other authors, you can say, hey, you know what? David Wood writes books that are kind of like that. Because what you'll see is all the people on that page are going to be going with the usual suspects. Every time. I've seen it happen dozens of times. It's like, well, who should I read? Oh, read best-selling author Y, best-selling author Z, A, B, C. It's always the usual suspects. The indies never get mentioned. And if they do get mentioned, usually it's indie author saying, oh, read my stuff, yay.
And nobody's going to pay attention to that.
But if you can be like, oh, hey, you should read so-and-so's books.
And I do the same for you guys,
and
too.
And so-and-so says, hey, you should read Nick Thacker's books. Then it's like people will actually look
that's
that up.
That's the word-of-mouth recommendation.
And that's how... So it can be done. I mean, it sounds cynical, but it can be done in a strategic way, especially if you make those good relationships with other authors. We are not competing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We can be building each other up. So network, find the people who you admire and who are willing to respect what you do. Get with them and think about, hey, I'm going to recommend you whenever I get a chance. Mm-hmm. And especially since, if I recommend David Wood, chances are they're going to end up reading my books anyway. that comes back to me right away. Mm-hmm. So,
of course, the true goal is when one of your author buddies says, "Who is the most overrated author?" Your goal is to make that list.
That's right.
But anyway,
but as to that though, I mean, I have been bad about the marketing promotion for my own works. I have not done it. I should have done it. It's daunting to look at that and say, well, I know what doesn't work, but I don't know what's going to work. And I'm now trying that. I'm trying to think, get out ahead of it. And I'm in a better space to do that right now than I have ever been. So who knows? Maybe later this year you're going to see that next Mirror Raiden novel.
All right. Now, you mentioned networking with other authors, and, you know, we're doing that right now, and it all came about because Nick dropped me an email and said, hey, I've read some of your stuff. What would you think about working together? And after a few more messages, suddenly we're having a little author retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun today. We spent several hours, and we have created a new series with new protagonists. We know what the first book is going to be about. We know what the next three are going to be about.
Yeah.
And one of our concepts is going to be hopefully not only joining our marketing forces, but, you know, we've created an author name that other people are going to write under. What was it like to go through that process today? Because normally, for me, it's a very solitary endeavor. Even with my collaborations, I'm usually creating this for everybody who's shown. I'm creating the story and passing it along. So what was the experience like today to create in a group?
This is Nick talking. And for me, in a word, it was awesome. It was great. I don't say that lightly either. I think brainstorming.
I'm saying it because I've got a gun right here.
He does have a gun right
here.
Literally right there. No, there is actually a gun.
And here.
He doesn't need a gun. He's got like 400,000 Warhammer guys behind me.
He's got an army.
If you need to.
Yeah, they're remote controlled, so careful what you say.
You know, the truth is, and everybody who's listening to this knows this, brainstorming is very difficult, and it's even more difficult when you're with people you don't know and have never done it before. Now, it's easy to brainstorm with my wife because we can both say, well, that idea sucks. I don't like you right now. And we can come back later and go...
That's called marriage.
You know, like, whatever. Yeah, and so, you know, and I love my wife. I'm not trying to talk bad about her, but it's different in this room. Like, none of us want, you know, we're not going to fit each other. We're not going to step on each other's toes. So there's a little bit of that feeling each other out kind of thing going on, but... Once we get past that, and we should have had whiskey a lot earlier in the day because that would have helped the brainstorming, I think. But once you get past
makes the podcast easier.
Podcast good, yeah. That's flowing out.
But that does make it difficult to differentiate between good and bad ideas. You get more ideas.
Tomorrow we wake up and go, what the hell
said,
are we writing?
Right, drunk, edit's over.
But that, you know, that's what I experienced today. We came in, I was like, you know, I don't know what to expect. I tried not to have an expectation because I don't want to be disappointed if you guys are completely on a different page than I am. But it turns out we weren't. We all were thinking the same sort of stuff. We're into the same thing. Any one of those 50 ideas we came up with would have been something we all could have jumped on. We happened upon one that we all were like, oh, that's cool. We came up with names. We hated some other names. Like, that's what you want in brainstorming. And I think we did that, and we banged out a pretty good outline for three books. I'm hoping we do it more often.
That should be a lot of fun. Sean, what was it like for you to do the face-to-face group brainstorming?
So, in the past, I have tried on at least two different occasions to create sort of that same thing at a distance using...
Yeah, I know you and I tried it once a long time ago, and it didn't happen.
It didn't work. And in the past, where it failed is because everybody was very married to their own ideas. Mm. It's like, yeah, I want to do that, but I want to do that. I want to focus on this character. And it just, for whatever reason, didn't work. Now, I still came up with some good ideas out of those brainstorming sessions that I eventually incorporated into my solo works. But I think that with indie writing, there's this idea that you are completely independent. And if you know anything about traditional publishing, you would realize that those guys... They don't write a book and then give it to people who then say, oh my God, that's so wonderful, we're just going to publish it. They're editors and agents, and it's just everybody's involved and giving them feedback and saying, no, that doesn't work. You need to do this. You need to write this story. This is what's going to sell. It is a collaborative process. Not quite as bad as, say, a movie where it's written by committee, but there's a lot of input and a lot of brainstorming, and the editor will tell the author, hey, you need to write a book about this. And, I did get, I was involved recently, last year in a ghostwriting project, writing with another author, and I was kind of given this, hey, you should write it about this and this. And I was like, okay, all right, I guess I'll work with that. And I did. And I think it was successful overall. And there was feedback with the other people involved and some, you need that. And you're not going to get that as an independent author necessarily. If you can get other people involved in it and bounce ideas off them. Even to this day, James Rollins still attends a critique group in his locale. Mm-hmm. He bounces ideas off other people. You read the acknowledgments page for any author, and they're going to give you, there's going to be a long list of people that they have somehow been involved in this story. Indie authors often try to do it all. You don't. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't. Mm-hmm. You need some input. This one, we started with where are we going to start? And so we threw out some ideas that we've been kicking around. And where we ended up was nowhere like where we started. Mm-hmm. But that's good, because now it truly was a collaborative experience. So I'm very positive about this as compared to some of the other ones we've done in the past.
I am too, yeah. It does feel like something real that's, you know, we're not just blowing smoke. I mean, this is going to happen. And
hey, we've already started a website. You've already started.
Yeah, we got the website. We can't go back now.
And we are going to link it to Pornhub to increase traffic. It's not ready yet, but we'll let you know when it is.
4chan links.
Yeah. All right. Well, before we wrap it up, just remind everybody of where they can find you online.
SeanEllisAuthor.com.
Oh, I was going to. He took mine.
Oh, okay.
You can find anything you want to know about Nick Thacker, just go to SeanEllisAuthor.com. That's S-E-A-N, the correct spelling, not S-H-A-U-W, whatever.
Sean of the Dead.
Yeah.
And I'm at NickThacker.com, and that's Nick, N-I-C-K. And then my last name is not Thatcher, like a lot of people think. It's T-H-A-C-K-E-R. I'm also that on Twitter and Facebook. Come find me.
All right. Well, unfortunately, David Wood is a famous clothier store, so I'm stuck with DavidWoodWeb.com.
Also an evangelist or something, right? There's
Christian. Oh, yeah. I occasionally get nasty emails about him. He gave an interview and dared to say something about the Crusades that was less than 100% positive from the Western world's view. And some guy wrote me he ripped me a new one and said, just wait till my book comes out, because the Crusades was strictly to eradicate the world of hateful Muslims, and you just wait. And I just wrote back, I'm afraid you have the wrong David.
You have the wrong David.
Have a nice day.
Wow.
So yeah, I get that. But anyway, I'm at DavidWoodWeb.com, but you guys already know where I am because you're listening to WoodOnWords.com. Check me out there as well. Sean and Nick, thanks for being here, and folks, we will see you next time.